Welcome to the Deep End by On Deck, a podcast for visionary builders, creators, and thinkers discuss world-changing stories and ideas. I'm your host, Marshall Kozlov.
There are many different factors in our environments that are impacting all those different factors, so access, utilization, outcomes, right? And virtual care or telemedicine on its own isn't going to solve for that. And so zooming in more, what if we did? What if we aligned every single thing that we did at Sport Health as a practice with the culture of the population?
On Deck is where ambitious people worldwide go to start companies, find their next roles, and invest in their careers. The Deep End invites the founders, operators, and investors from the On Deck community and beyond to turn their experiences into ideas others need to start their own odysseys. Let's dive in. Joining me this week in the Deep End is Dan Miller, founder and CEO of Spora Health. Spora Health is a radically inclusive, virtual-first telemedicine provider focused on health equity and providing culturally competent care. Today's conversation is about disparities in healthcare. Dan shares a bit about his family's experience with the healthcare system and outlines how technology can help alleviate some of the challenges that others in similar boats may experience. We also discuss social determinants of health, undiagnosed depression in Black men, and the health concern narratives shared by different cultures. To learn more about Spora, you can visit their website at sporahealth.com. All right, time for the episode. Let's dive in. Dan Miller, welcome to the Deep End.
Thanks, Marshall. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, glad you're here. Let's just start really basic and then we'll expand outwards. Explain what you are building at Spora Health.
So Spora Health is a virtual primary care practice for people of color, specifically focusing on Black Americans and Latino populations today. So we have set out to build an equitable primary care system. And so for us, that really sort of oscillates around the thesis of culture-centered care, which is sort of evolution of patient-centered care models. And so we think about putting the culture of the populations that we serve at the center of everything we do, as represented by the brand, but also extending into the actual clinical model that we've created, provider representation in across our practice, the things that we focus on, et cetera.
Yeah. So let's just start with the Black and Latino part. So like, what are the shared health concerns, narratives, like specific circumstances that make these the two communities too? Because once again, persons of color can be thought of, very broadly. How do you get about to narrowing on this specific market?
Well, I mean, so yeah, we started with Black folks first, just, you know, I've been Black 37 years now, so
Personal experience.
You know, I'm in a Black body by now, you know, and, I figured I'd start there as well. And also, you know, in all honesty, I'm just thinking about my own lived experience and lived experience of my loved ones, you know, in speaking with, you know, my mother and learning about, challenging pregnancy that she had with the oldest of my two younger brothers, and because of the age difference, she had different OB, and you know I was around 10, so I had no idea that you know she was sort of struggling throughout that pregnancy, and you know until I asked her about it. And similarly, you know, was a caretaker for my great grandmother during end of life for her when she had moved up to stay with us in New Jersey from North Carolina and wasn't comfortable with the doctors and the nurses at the center that she was at. And so when I was in middle school, but you know, when I wasn't in season, didn't have practice, I would come home and take care of her until my parents got home. And that was a problem born out of, you know, necessity and to make my grandmother comfortable. But I most certainly wasn't the sort of best option, right? And so in thinking about all of these sort of narratives and experiences that I've had primarily, and then also just sort of through, you know, experiences of my loved ones, I knew that I wanted to focus on equities and disparities. And then when we, you know, immediately, you know, like you think about populations that are most impacted by these within a sort of primary care lens, and Black folks and Latino populations are towards the top of the list, if not top of the list, or across a lot of different spectrums. And so it made sense. And then also it was just something that's really, really important for me. Just when I sort of think about my legacy and you know, what I want to spend my time doing on Earth, I think I've acquired a unique set of skills to help folks, Black folks and folks of color, more specifically, live more fulfilling and joyful lives by being healthier. And so this is the current manifestation of that.
Yeah, awesome answer. Here's something I'm curious about. I'm sure, especially in the health tech intersection space, you have to deal with a lot of big, grand, techno-optimistic narratives. And I look at your webpage here. So you see me looking up, it's me actually looking at content, not my email. Hate that usually. But Spora Health is a radically inclusive, virtual-first telemedicine provider. A lot of folks will argue that telemedicine, virtual-first, those are already, just by the nature of the technology, by the fact that they're democratizing, the fact that a lot of people have access to some form of internet or a computer. Therefore, why is it important to zoom in closer on persons of color given the specific context?
Yeah, this is a great question. And so, you know, virtual care as a utility is no longer, you know, innovation. Most certainly a commodity. This is table stakes, right? But in 2020, we're still facing, a mass awareness of the inequities and disparities that were impacting different populations. Virtual care had been around for, you know, and largely adopted, arguably, for at least 5 years, right? So then why are we still in a place, why is you know, telemedicine and virtual care sort of not solving for, you know, actually creating, you know, equitable access, utilization rates, you know, and ultimately outcomes? It's because, you know, we're interacting with humans, and there are humans on both sides, right?
Let's start there.
And research has really caught up, and there are many different factors in our environments that are impacting all those different factors. So access, utilization, outcomes, right? And virtual care or telemedicine on its own isn't going to solve for that. And so zooming in more, you know, and it was a hypothesis. It was, you know, what if we align every single thing that we did at Spora Health as a practice with the culture of the populations we serve? I'd already seen this sort of category emerging. You could argue that TIA is very similar. Obviously, Folks is in this category, Plume as well, and there are others. And so, but I didn't see anything in the market, you know, focusing on Black Americans. You know, this is, you know, back when we were solely focusing on them as a population. And but we also learned that there's, you know, significant issues outside of just interfacing with technology that are impacting how folks make healthcare related decisions. And those, you know, broadly include social determinants of health for sure. But those are problems that, you know, exist upstream from us that, you know, we don't have much control over. But there are also empirically many dynamics that are leading to inequities and disparities, that show up in the clinical encounter. And that is something that we could solve for. And so, you know, started to look around at, you know, how we might address that problem, and arrived at really learning that essentially providers in the United States aren't trained at all. Well, I wouldn't say at all, but they're not required to receive health equity or cultural competence training as part of the accreditation process. And so another way of saying that is, you know, no accrediting body, CMS, et cetera, is requiring a health equity or cultural competence training as part of the accreditation process for new doctors or providers in the United States. They're recommended, but they're not required. And so providers want to learn these skills. They recognize that They need to learn these skills to meet the expectation of underserved populations, but they don't know where to start. And so we created a training called the Sport Institute, focusing on educating our providers on these dynamics. It's all evidence-based, rooted in behavior change. And we educate our doctors, and this is for our providers of color and providers that aren't of color as well. Everyone goes through the training to help them better understand how to meet the cultural expectation of our populations, but also help them better understand how to apply cultural competence in a clinical setting.
Yeah, and you really set me up as an interviewer because I wrote down like 18 different concepts I want to go through for the general audience who hasn't heard. My partner works in healthcare, so I'm decently normie aware, but we'll go through a bit. But I want to just start with the stakes here. Because when a normal person, when a person who doesn't work in the healthcare space, just generically works in tech, business, whatever, hears terms like cultural competency, it brings it to mind HR. So I'm not saying that in the sense of disparage, but this is a thing, you've got a training and you do the training, but in your context, the stakes are actually quite high. They're actually like severe medical outcomes in a negative sense that come out of this lack of cultural competency. So can we just zoom in for folks who don't understand how different this is from probably the typical experience they've had of cultural competency in the workplace?
Yeah, I you're hitting the nail on the head, and I've said this in meetings with benefits teams. It's the opportunity cost of not acting here is immense, and so at best we're talking about status quo and employees of color, folks of color, or still have higher probabilities of experiencing chronic conditions, and broadly speaking are predisposed to a lower quality of life through these inequities and disparities. At worst, it's death, right? And so this is like, we're not talking about something that's really sort of lightweight here. There's significant outcomes that come from this sort of skilling up of not just sort of benefits teams to better understand how to think about designing benefits for their employees, but also the providers as well, obviously, right? And these things are, I'm happy to sort of dig in on a bit about the content, but it's the stakes are extremely high, and we take it very seriously. As evident as, we just released a program focusing on folks, birthing persons throughout pregnancy, but also through their fourth trimester. So about 100 days postpartum after birth. And so, and this is within a primary care sense, right? And this is what I'm talking about. This is a really prime example of thinking through things in a culture-centered way, in that we had already sort of built the foundational blocks to be able to provide primary care as a practice, via mobile and web, and we're already sort of in network with United Healthcare as well. But we really learned that a large percentage of our members are women, and women that are most engaged are focusing on family planning. But then also, obviously, when we start to think about inequities and disparities as a subset of our population, Black women are, especially folks that are pregnant, are there's significant factors that are increasing their maternal mortality and morbidity rates, from 3 to 4 times of white women around the same age. And so it was a prime sort of opportunity for us to focus on. And so we collaborated with Black female OBs, PAs, and other providers to build a curriculum from the ground up that's aligned with women of color and help them understand the risks they should be aware of across their entire pregnancy. And then it's also led by a doula, and we make sure that we connect with them once a week with the doula, but also there are community-based programs. And so, folks that are in the same sort of stage of their pregnancy, they'll also collaborate as a cohort. And we call those bump groups as well. But again, all of this is evidence-based. And so, there's science behind, the actual, the program design, the curricula, even the products. But if you just sort of think about things in a patient-centered way, you might miss out on some of the nuances that can make content rich, and that really that things that that certain subsets of the population really care about that can increase engagement. And engagement is what saves lives. It's what increases quality of life here. So the stakes are extremely high, and we think about it. We just take it very seriously.
So let's go through some of the terms you used in no particular order. So can you really unpack what the social determinants of health are?
Yeah, well, largely, I mean, these are factors that exist. I said upstream, but, these are factors that exist before you enter the doctor's office that impact your quality of life. So whether or not you can get a ride to the doctor's office, so transportation, right? Food security, things like actually having access, if we're talking about telemedicine, additionally housing, et cetera. So these are sort of major factors that exist outside of the sort of clinical encounter that can deter folks from actually getting care and continue to stay engaged as well.
And I was really interested in the downstream point of the human-centered design point, the environment. So these three factors, just like access, utilization, and outcomes. Can you just explain like what those three concepts mean, what the implications are from them for your approach?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we say access, we're talking about a front door, virtually or otherwise, offline as well. And so can folks, not to be sort of redundant here, but can folks sort of access the technology to engage with the provider? Even assuming that they can, so they have sort of, access to the internet and or they have a smartphone, then is the actual, is there inventory? Is the pricing model accessible? We're including all that when we, into the definition of access for us. Just because for our population, these are factors that are really important as well. When we think about folks that are uninsured or for Medicaid populations, joining concierge memberships isn't feasible. And so we need to be thinking, we need to think more broadly in ways that we can still provide care that's aligned with where our patients are at and ways in which we can meet them. When we think about engagement and utilization, then for us, it's really getting them sort of the first step through the first major step in the product is to complete a health risk assessment. And so taking a step back, we, Black folks in particular have higher probabilities of being diagnosed with hypertension, prediabetes, coronary artery disease, chronic kidney disease, and some others. But also, there's significant research that suggests, when folks have a better understanding of sort of where they are on a spectrum of risk, then they have the information that they need to act. And so for us, we wanted to make sure that we focused on health literacy as well and making sure that we are showing up and giving in the relationship first before we're asking our patients to provide, billing information or asking them to assume that they want to book an actual appointment with one of our doctors. And so we the first step is for them to go through an actual health risk assessment. It's now optional, And so folks on the other end of that will have this output that they can take with them wherever they go. And they'll have an understanding of sort of where they are in a risk profile for things like prediabetes, as an example, hypertension, et cetera. That data gets shared with them, but also gets shared with the provider when they do book. And so that, you know, there's some sort of foundation that they can also start to talk about for longitudinal care plans. But that's how that's in our research and in our experience so far, we're seeing hundreds of patients is folks respond really well to getting access to information for free, essentially. They just have to pay with their time. And then they actually can share that with any other provider that they need. And then also it sort of, again, it establishes a baseline for them to work from with their provider at Sport Health. And then lastly, when we think about outcomes, it's making sure that for folks that have been recommended a treatment plan, or they need to be referred to a specialist or in an urgent care or acute care setting, they need a prescription. We make sure that we have staff on board that is following up with them. We're guiding them through the entire process. We're making sure that they know where they're heading. We've learned that, especially for Black folks, providers tend to talk more during appointments than when those providers are interacting with white patients empirically. And so this is an entire sort of module we cover in the Sport Institute, but I bring it up because that tends to leave folks, without objectively having enough time to sort of discuss treatment plans and, next steps, et cetera, ask questions. But also folks leaving, those experiences where they don't have enough time to talk, feeling like obviously they're not heard, but also feeling like they don't have much of a connection, which leads to a lack of compliance and sort of utilization there. So for us, we make sure that we over communicate, not just, we focus on that from the provider perspective. We measure our patient's experience, but we also, from a sort of product and clinical operations perspective, we make sure that we over communicate as well. Going as far as being on the phone with patients to make sure they're at the right pharmacy. When we think about sort of outcomes, we want to make sure that we keep folks engaged, that we have enough time to actually get to a point where we can really see what the outcomes are, if they're in a sort of, long tail treatment plan.
Something I'm curious about, looking at the population that uses your services, are these folks who have typically interacted with the traditional primary care medical system, or are they really getting onboarded for the first time? Like what differences in experiences are you just finding out? I'm really interested in the research side of this.
Yeah. We'll be publishing quite a bit actually soon. There are a large percentage of folks that don't have a PCP, a primary care provider, and they haven't seen a primary care provider in years. And they're using Sport Health.
Pre-COVID years, correct?
Yeah.
Yes. A lot of, I just made it to, let's just say I skipped out on a couple of things but that's a long time scale here. Sorry, go on.
No, yeah, exactly. So pre-COVID years and they connect with the mission. Some folks explicitly are looking for, providers of color to interact with because they've had negative experiences. Other folks, typically folks that are skewing towards the sort of younger side of our membership, they're just used to optionality in the market, and they are used to convenience in the market, and they connect with the mission, and they lived through a pandemic, understand the sort of risks that are now associated just inherently with their existence here in the United States. And so it ranges, but there are some folks that are, we now have Sport Mamas, that's the name of the maternity program, mamas that are, they have, some of them are providers, and They engage daily with us, tracking vitals, et cetera, and are, you know, over the moon that it exists. And some folks are, on Medicaid are using, you know, services like this for the first time.
You know, it's interesting when you refer to convenience on a personal level. It's so I just turned, or I'm about to turn 30 as this is recording. So I'm going through the various 30 something health things. Hair started to thin a tiny bit, and I'm looking at how convenient the market is for all of these services. And another way of saying convenience is commodity. It's undifferentiated. Everything basically does the same thing. If anyone has any tips for how I should pick a direct-to-consumer hair company, I have absolutely no idea other than what the Brooklyn subway tells me. Even that isn't particularly differentiated. Like, how do you get, because it's true, like how do you, beyond just the obvious, like, important language, like how do you think about, and this isn't just with your company, it just seems like everything is commoditizing in your space. And I would just love, and once again, the space is big, but everything just feels undifferentiated the more virtual it gets. The only brand I really think seriously about is just One Medical. And that's because, hey, like I was in DC, I moved to New York, it was super easy. Like that actually has a brand move. That's because it's rooted. Even though they have virtual care, it's still rooted in something physical. I walk by one and I think about it. How do you just think about commodification in the broader health to health adjacent space?
Yeah, well, I mean, I would even argue that, you know, and I love One Medical. We're standing on the shoulders of the folks over there. But they haven't innovated on the care model until they're really forced to in 2021. And, you know,
that's COVID, you mean, in terms of the care model?
Well,
good question.
So, I think COVID was an aspect of it, but you know, the population they were serving, and I was a One Medical member, you know, living here in the Bay Area, sort of upper middle class, upper class folks in major cities across the United States. And, you know, most recently I've publicly started to talk about equity as a concern. Previously, I mean, it's just a really nice doctor's office. There was convenience because the lab was in the primary care office, and there was a nice sort of technology layer on top for that was, you know, sort of aligned with the population they were serving. That's great. It's fine. But when we're talking about, you know, what is built into the One Medical care model that is either a pathway for someone that has, you know, type 2 diabetes or is pre-diabetic that is built into the actual product. It's still rooted in, you know, the experience with the provider, which isn't innovative. That has existed, you know, previously. So that's what I'm talking about the innovation of the care model. A good segue is like how I think about this is, folks have been, I believe, building on top of, the successes of other companies, which I think ultimately hasn't really led to a lot of innovation in the space, to your point. And some other folks have, been adamant about this as well. For us, and you know, our position is to really use culture and take a population health approach to figuring out what needs to be built and why, from the care model to how our providers are going to treat a patient that is pre-diabetic or has a high probability for hypertension or chronic kidney disease, or even folks that are score high on a PHQ-9. Black males, who are we referring to?
What's
them?
PHQ-9?
Exactly. Sorry. it's a depression assessment. So folks that assess, high on a depression assessment that are Black males, for that population, how do we treat them? Whom do we refer them to? Because depression for Black males tends to go underdiagnosed or undiagnosed typically the symptoms are demonstrated more somatically versus in relation to other populations. So, which providers don't have a lot of training around, so it tends to get missed. But there are now folks like Hurdle in the market. And so that allows companies like us to become more innovative around what a care pathway looks like, what the experience or the referral experience looks like for a patient that fits this specific use case. And we're using culture and population health as a North Star. I would encourage other entrepreneurs and founders out there to find what makes sense for them and their populations. But that's how we're thinking about it.
Yeah. And this is where we get to the business model part, because like you said, I like the way you explained what One Medical is, because, and it doesn't even have to be purely racialized. It's just, they serve a very specific population that is going to lean one way. So once again, if you're in certain types of cities and you make certain amounts of money, it's like an expectation that you would use something like One Medical. I totally get that, but that's a population that's served, but it's a lucrative population. It's a population where it's very obvious. Once again, this is why you can serve that group and then kind of coast. Coast is unfair. I'm sorry. Don't cancel me. One Medical, I'm enjoying your use of the services, but just you could stagnate at an innovation level. How does one build a serious business around underserved populations where the deliverables are less obvious from a monetization? Monetization sounds too crass because this is like people's lives, but like monetization. We're on a tech podcast, so I can say that.
We've already sort of touched on it a little bit earlier. And I think it makes sense to sort of set the stage here. The alternative is again, lower quality of life, lower utilization rates, worse health outcomes for the system, for the healthcare system. These populations are more expensive, not engaged in more cost effective services across healthcare, like primary care. Seeing higher sort of utilization rates in sort of urgent care facilities, very expensive. ER facilities and readmissions, very, very expensive. And so I mentioned that first because, thinking about building a business in this space, you really just have to provide high quality care and make sure that folks are engaged. And there's opportunity through, obviously, outcomes, as we transition to broader value-based care systems. The revenue comes from keeping folks healthier and engaged in getting access to high quality care, making sure that their satisfaction with the services they're getting are extremely high. In fee-for-service arrangements, it's really, you're getting, you're building the business based off of utilization. So, but it's the same thing.
Could you explain what fee-for-service is?
Yeah, absolutely. So, fee-for-service is a type of reimbursement arrangement with a insurance company in which providers, doctors get reimbursed for each service. They get a fee for each individual encounter. And so the system incentivizes quantity over quality, which has led to worse health outcomes and very expensive sort of system to just provide care. We've been thoughtfully expanding and transitioning to value-based care, which is, these arrangements are based off of the value that you're providing to the patients and outcomes-based reimbursements. So the healthier folks are, satisfaction is built into this. So the happier they are with their service, dictates the sort of the reimbursement rate that their practices will receive and providers will receive. But I mentioned fee-for-service because it's similar in that you really have to start with an incredible experience for your patients that they're happy with, that will keep them engaged. And thus you'll be able to build a model off of sort of the utilization coming from those patients. I think there's also opportunities for expanding into thinking about new models that don't currently exist. So whether it's, you know, for subsets of populations, what is a culture centered plan look like? What is a culture centered sort of affiliate network or provider network look like? And I say that because, you know, like, you know, making it even more concrete. So for underserved populations, let's focus on Black women that are pregnant. So for folks going through their pregnancy, how do we create either a plan or a practice that is optimized for this subset of a population to increase outcomes and decrease costs? Currently, there is an adoption laterally across a lot of different companies engaged to really produce an initiative like this. But I would not be surprised if more folks start to think through these types of models, because as more diverse populations continue to grow in the United States, and we collect more and more data on, not just, the sort of inequities and disparities that are impacting different populations, whether it be folks, in rural locations or otherwise, and there are other companies like Spore Health that are entering the market that will be able to show outcomes and data that are producing better satisfactory metrics and quality metrics in the status quo. I think we'll start to see more sort of investment in initiatives that are thinking about things from a really population specific sense, which I hope to see, because I think there's a higher probability of being able to address specific issues that are really expensive on the healthcare system.
So three last medium to biggish questions. First, you consistently say the word culture. And I think in this conversation that really means something. So can you just expand on what you mean by that?
So when we say culture, we're talking about the social linguistic norms that are present in different populations that we serve. And so an example would be when we are creating, a treatment plan for a patient that might have prediabetes, trying to focus on lowering potentially someone's A1C, we take into account folks' diet.
And you know what I'm going to ask? What is A1C?
Yeah, exactly. We ask exactly. And this is what we're talking about, culture. Like, it's, I've heard this a lot about, and from some of my colleagues, we're thinking about South Asian Americans and some of my friends that are Indian are like, good luck telling, folks that to not eat, sort of rice and roti and a diet to decrease sort of, thinking about glucose levels. And so those things need to be, providers and practices need to have that awareness of those aspects of different populations when you're asking them to do things, otherwise, it's challenging and you lose credibility.
So then the next question would be, I'm really interested in a podcaster in wording, and on the website you say virtual first. So to what degree will there be in person when it comes to these sorts of practices you're building?
There absolutely will be. There will be Spora wellness centers. When we see virtual first, that is the front door. We most certainly make referrals out to in-person providers and practices we have relationships with. In the future, absolutely, it will be, a seamless experience a la a One Medical.
Yeah, and for the last question here, I'd love for you to, because we've talked about a lot of like big weighty concepts, a little less on the exact specifics of Spore, and I think that's a good thing. But I'd like to close with just a real roadmap of how you've approached this. Like, where did you start? Where are you at now? And on the longer term vision scale, if you're pitching this to VCs, when you are pitching this to VCs, how do you articulate what that is? So just the overall roadmap, where you started, where you are, and then where you're going.
So this started pretty far from primary care, actually. I practiced as a Buddhist and was really deepening my spiritual practice, but also meditation practice. And this is back in 2019. I went to, there's a meditation center in, I think it's Fairfax, California, called Spirit Rock. And there was, back in the 60s, there were a lot of, like Angela Davis and a bunch of other sort of Black folks went to Spirit Rock and they had a sort of a Black Buddha sort of retreat and called it The Awakening. And somehow I got I don't even know how I got this invite, but I found out that they were having an awakening too. And I went and it was very moving that there was a space created that, in my opinion, was culture centered. And I was then thinking about sort of physical or rather physiological benefits from meditation and learned that through my own research and curiosity, there's still some more research that needs to be done, but hypothetically, there's a connection between meditation and broadly epigenetics and sort of changing the methylation that's happening on the gene, which can have an impact on things like cortisol, as an example, which Black folks in particular, when we start to talk about transgenerational trauma, a physiological marker of this is higher rates of cortisol across the system. This has also been referred to as the weathering effect. That sort of Black folks living in a racialized society are exposed to more stressors, and this sort of these markers on the genes get passed down when women are giving birth. And so that was the impetus of what ultimately sort of
happened. That got way deeper than I thought I was going to go, and I'm really glad you went there. This is the first time Angela Davis has come up on the podcast.
Yeah,
so I applaud you.
I was thinking about, okay, this is an interesting idea. This is a compelling, sort of thought. And thought that it fit within, sort of meditation, mental wellness, fitness, mental health. But zoomed out a bit and arrived at, I think the largest that this idea could, apply, existed within a sort of primary care framework for at least back then. I think it's broader than that now. But that was the path of me sort of arriving at culture centered as a sort of thesis and wanting to sort of deploy it through primary care. When we think about where we are today, we're now, taking care of patients, their primary care providers, where, we can support urgent care and acute care issues for folks that have, sort of high acuity issues, like the flu or, a rash or burn or something. We extended into maternity, still within a sort of primary care lens, and it all fits the thesis. It all fits the mission and the vision of the company. And even from a sort of a product technology component, we're still using the same stack. We're not working on, five different technologies. These are all sort of things that coexist together for folks, depending on where they are in their journey and what they need. And so when we look at the future, we'll continue to expand that. We've done really well with largely Black Americans. We just joined a plan in Texas, primarily for Latino populations. We have a 85 NPS score to date. Sort of industry average is a -1 to +3. So I think we've definitely tapped into something that's markedly better than the status quo for our patients. we want to continue to push that forward with other populations. And as we do, you know, expand to other geographies as well, understanding that there are very nuanced differences between, you know, sort of Black populations in South Florida versus New York versus, you know, Washington State. And don't want to assume that it's a monolith. No, it's not a monolith. And don't want to assume that we need to provide care in that way. And so we want to continue to iterate and get smarter with the Spore Institute, for sure. But again, so then when we think about the future, it's expanding access to the learnings that we have from the Spore Institute and potentially building some sort of data layer so that we can, when you think about, you know, sort of powering other provider networks, so they can be powered by Spore Health or powered by Spore Institute. Folks can go through the training or can get access to our sort of rubrics and how we've thought about managing population health. And obviously we'll be able to demonstrate the outcomes we've been able to drive. And that then can allow us to expand how, well, just how broad, you know, Spore Health can actually be and how many folks can actually have access to the quality of care that don't just have access to Spore Health individually.
Really well said. Dan, this has been really great. I'd love for you just to shout out the website, any places folks should go to learn more. You've got interesting research coming out soon. So just any takeaways for the audience would be really great.
Yeah, we're at sporehealth.com. We're at Spore Health across Instagram, LinkedIn. Those are we're sort of most active. For folks that are excited about learning more about the sort of foundational sort of curriculum behind the care that we provide, and we're institute.sporehealth.com. And similarly, folks that are interested in the maternity program, it's mamas.sporehealth.com as well.
Great, Dan. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for joining us in the Deep End. If you enjoyed your stay, give us a review on Apple Podcasts and share this episode with your friends and colleagues to help grow the show with us. We've also got show notes and more episodes available at ideas.beyonddeck.com. See you next time.